question and my degree of comprehension when I began insisting that the driver slow down before he killed us. When we finally made it to the first aid station, Kenneth and Chad returned to the chaos at the river. Tom stayed with Bill and me. When Kenneth and Chad returned to the river, they first tried to find the young men who had been such great help in carrying me through the forest. These young men were nowhere to be found, and the people from the village had no idea who they could be talking about. They didn't know of anyone fitting their description in the village, so the people thought Chad and Kenneth must be mistaken. Angels? Chad and Kenneth found their return trip through the bamboo forest to the riverbank was even more difficult than when they had carried me out. They found the forest to be even thicker and the hillside even steeper than they remembered. It made the success of their earlier efforts seem even less plausible, unless one accepted that the process of my rescue was almost entirely a result of divine intervention. Once all of the remaining boaters were accounted for, Kenneth and Chad tried to recover the two boats that were still trapped at the bottom of the waterfall. It was nearly impossible. The rock upon which they had been standing when they fished me out of the water was gone. It was not possible for them to stand in the current of the steep waterfall. It was impossible for them to reach or even touch the boats. It took more than an hour of dedicated working and suffering through multiple snapped ropes to get the first boat out. In order to achieve this, they had to first bend and fold both boats in half by securing lines to the boat ends and rotating them such that the current could do this work. When they finally retrieved the lines they had been using, they saw that there had been enough friction and force between the lines to melt the knots together. As they returned to Pucón, they were exhausted and overwhelmed by the absolute impossibility of my rescue and the supernatural aspects of what had occurred. God's presence and purposeful intervention was clear to all those who were present on the scene. Tom, Kenneth, Chad, and Anne have all told me they feel that the situation went from one of total and absolute failure and hopelessness to one of success without any meaningful input from them. They have described it to me as a choreographed performance in which they were each just playing their roles. To this day, they continue to feel that ours is not just a good story. It wasn't just one miracle. It was a constellation of miracles for which there is no possible explanation other than God's intervention. As Chad later said, "Let's not let life muddle what happened. We were all part of a miracle." Anne has reported that she was overwhelmed by the simultaneous and contrasting feelings of being so helpless and small in the universe and of being so loved by God that he chose to be present. She, and I think all of us, are still feeling undeserving of his intervention. With all of the suffering and people in need, it is difficult to understand how or why he intervened that day on the Fuy River in Chile. But he clearly did. Anne has described feeling both helpless and remarkably liberated. She knows that God is in control, and she feels that she now understands the verse in the Bible that describes how you must give up everything in order to gain everything. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. Mark 8, verse 35, New Revised Standard Version. Chapter 14, Return to Wyoming. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Hebrews 13, verse 5, New King James Version. The first aid clinic in Choshuenco was quite rudimentary, with no diagnostic equipment and few supplies. Bill was relieved to find a supply of plaster, however, and expertly applied long splints to each of my legs. I don't think I said much, as I felt myself drifting back and forth between this world and the one I had left. I was still fully immersed in the visions, the passion, the intensity, and the love I had just witnessed in God's kingdom. In trying to sort out and make sense of what was happening, I made one absolute decision. I was not going to stay in Chile for my medical care, nor was I going to stop in any of the large American cities through which we would pass on our way back to our home in Wyoming. Jackson Hole had a great hospital, doctors that I trusted, and most importantly, I knew that I needed to be with my children. Bill and Tom loaded me into the back seat of the pickup truck for the beginning of our journey home. We drove to Coique, where there was a small airport. Finding the airport closed, we drove on to Valdivia, a bustling city of more than 100,000. Bill's heart sank and he was brought to tears as we approached the airport entrance and saw that the entry gate was closed and locked. There would be no more flights until the morning. We drove into the city and found a small hotel with a vacancy. As Tom said goodbye, Bill carried me up the stairs and we settled in for a long and restless night of waiting for the morning. A taxi returned us to the airport at the crack of dawn, at which point Bill found a small plane that was going to Santiago. He secured seats and gently lifted me into the plane. Bill was heroic. He dealt with the bags, the tickets, and with me in my debilitated condition. I cannot tell you why we decided to take commercial flights rather than calling for a medical evacuation, but it seemed like the right thing to do. Bill carried me off one plane and on to the next. The flight from Santiago to Dallas carried few people, and there were several empty seats across which I could stretch out. Although the flight attendants raised their eyebrows at my appearance and behavior, none questioned my condition too thoroughly. We were met with a wheelchair upon our arrival at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, and we uneventfully passed through customs and back into the United States. Bill thought it would attract less interest if only one of my legs was bundled up, so prior to boarding our next flight to Salt Lake City, Utah, he removed the splint from one of my legs. Despite this, the flight attendants expressed significant concern after watching Bill gently lift me into my seat. In response to their questions, we stretched the truth. A lot. We explained that we were both orthopedic surgeons and that I had injured my ankle while on vacation, and we simply thought I would be more comfortable with it splinted. The flight attendants clearly did not believe this fable, so they brought the flight's captain to speak with us. He explained his concern that I would be a hindrance and an obstacle in the event of an emergency landing or crash. I chuckled internally and wanted to explain that after what I had already been through, I was sure this would be the safest flight he had ever flown. What I actually said was that I was trained in emergency situations, my injury wasn't really too bad, and I would definitely not slow anyone down. Satisfied, he returned to the cockpit, and we were on our way. I began to have some difficulty breathing upon our arrival in Utah. When we stopped for something to drink, I found that I was weak, ill, and unable to breathe deeply or fully. I felt very distant, and I don't think either Bill or I were thinking clearly at this point. We never discussed going to one of the local hospitals in Salt Lake City, as I was resolute in returning to Jackson for my care. Thinking that I might have a blood clot or pneumonia, we telephoned my internist and asked him to meet us in our office upon our return. Bill then loaded me into the back seat of our pickup truck, and we started the 5-hour drive from Utah to our home in Wyoming. When my breathing became even more labored several hours into the drive, I began to question my decisions and to wonder if I would make it back to my children. Bill called my internist and suggested that he should meet us in the emergency room rather than in our own medical facility. The elevation gain as we drove over Pine Creek Pass, elevation 6,720 feet, caused my breathing to deteriorate even further. I began to apologize to my husband, my loving, faithful, constant husband whom I adored. He had been one of God's greatest gifts to me. And I apologized to him for not being able to make it home, for not stopping sooner, for choosing to return to Jackson, for leaving him, for dying. I apologized again and again and again. In Chile, I had felt confident about my decision to return to Jackson Hole because I thought it was God's plan. Now that it looked like I would die before reaching home, I was filled with remorse at my presumed misunderstanding. I was overcome with grief for my husband and for my young children. Willie, Betsy, Elliot, and Peter were so loving and vulnerable that I felt great sorrow at not being able to make it for them, for failing them. Chapter 15. The Power of Prayer. If two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three come together in my name, there am I with them. Matthew 18, verses 19 and 20, New International Version. As we drove over Teton Pass, elevation 8,431 feet, I began breathing so shallowly and taking in so little oxygen that I could no longer speak. Although I was quite comfortable, I began to fade in and out of consciousness as my usually law-abiding husband pushed harder on the accelerator and forced the speedometer even higher. When we reached the hospital parking lot, the truck door was jerked open and I was quickly moved out of the truck and onto a gurney by the emergency room staff. When I looked up from the gurney and recognized the face of my internist looking down at me, I knew I was at last home and immediately lost consciousness. I was taken into the emergency room and placed in one of the small examination cubicles. My oxygen levels were dangerously low and did not respond to the administration of oxygen. Preliminary evaluation showed an advanced pneumonia and acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. ARDS is a severe inflammatory reaction in the lungs to a major insult, such as a near drowning, fat embolism, pneumonia, smoke inhalation, or other major trauma. This reactive swelling of the lung tissue often develops after 24 to 48 hours, interferes with the ability to exchange oxygen, and often leads to death. My internist gravely told my husband that I would probably not make it through the night. Natalie, the medical assistant of my internist, was sitting in the cubicle next to mine, separated by a thin curtain. She had driven another member of our church, Sherry, to the emergency room for the treatment of a cut finger. When they saw the facial expressions of the people around me and heard the words of my internist, they immediately began to pray. They prayed for the saving of my life, for the healing of my body, for the emotional strength of my family, and for us to be enveloped by God's grace. They prayed intensely, passionately, and specifically. They soon left the emergency room and went to the high school basketball game, where much of the community was cheering on our young people. They quickly sent around the message of my injury and encouraged others to begin praying. Within an hour of my emergency room arrival, there were a great many people praying for me. Natalie went home and continued to pray fervently. She prayed until 4 a.m, when suddenly she felt like she could rest. While others were lifting me up to the Lord with their prayers, I was lying in the intensive care unit. For much of the night, my body struggled for survival. According to the medical records, about 4 a.m., the same time Natalie felt released from prayer, my vital signs stabilized, and the nurses were able to take a tentative sigh of relief. It looked like I was going to make it after all. A friend of mine later told me that she thought I survived the night because with all of those people praying for me, God would have been embarrassed to let me die. I don't know about that. But God's compassion certainly reinforced the power of prayer to everyone involved. Chapter 16. Clarity of Vision. Don't worry about anything. Instead, pray about everything. Tell God what you need and thank Him for all that He has done. If you do this, you will experience God's peace. Philippians 4, verse 6, New Living Translation. I was awakened the following morning by the arrival of two deacons from our church. They own a local outdoor shop and came bearing a stack of great magazines for me to read. As delightful as my deacons were, I will admit that I was looking forward to their departure so I could get started on the magazines. Strangely, I felt great. I had no pain and was quite clear mentally. I picked up a cross-country skier magazine as soon as they left and was surprised to find that, despite my historically having 20/20 vision, the pages were too blurry for me to read. I put them aside and turned on the television. The picture on the screen was too blurry for me to understand. The nurse came in, and I found that she, too, looked blurry. I was no longer comfortable having a conversation, as I could not look at any one spot for more than a couple of seconds without the blurriness becoming too uncomfortable. It was very distracting and irritating, so I opted to take a nap. When I awoke, I asked the nurse if there was a Bible anywhere. She produced a Gideon's Bible. I always wondered who read those, and I proceeded to look for verses about gaining strength and such. I looked to Psalms and searched for well-known verses such as these. God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Psalm 46, verse 1, New International Version. When you call to me, I will answer you. I will be with you when you are in trouble. I will save you and honor you. Psalm 91, verse 15, God's Word. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Philippians 4, verse 13, New Revised Standard Version. Unfortunately, the printing in the Bible was also too blurry for me to read. Just as I was closing the book in frustration and tossing it aside, something distinct and clear flashed before my eyes. Presuming that my vision had cleared, I returned to the Psalms. The words were still blurry. Again, I began to carelessly flip through the pages as I closed the book. Again, something became clear and legible. I then carefully searched through the pages until I was able to find the verse that was crystal clear. It read, "Rejoice always." 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 16, English Standard Version. Wow. I began to contemplate the meaning of this verse as it was clearly a directive from God. In my contemplations, I thought about the fact that a joyful heart and a joyful spirit are clearly important to God, and the word joy is mentioned throughout all the books of the Bible. I had always been a happy person and generally saw the rosy side of things, but joy is clearly different than happiness. It is not based on circumstances, but on the presence, hope, and promises of God. Even when it feels as if we are being crushed by earthly troubles, we can remain joyful. If we keep our focus on God, our spirit cannot be trampled. Joy is a state of mind and a state of being. It reflects a conscious choice to believe in the promises of the Bible. Later in the day, a second verse became clear to my vision. It read, "Pray without ceasing." 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 17, English Standard Version. Prayer is the way we are able to communicate with our Lord. This verse directs us to maintain a continually open line of communication with him. It instructs us that we should live a life of prayer, continuously offering silent prayers with every breath we take and always listening for God's leading. In the past, I had believed in the power to pray for oneself, for forgiveness, for change, for insight, and so forth. I had subscribed to the concept that prayer does not change the outcome of a situation, but it changes us in the process. While I still hold firmly to my belief in this aspect of prayer, I have subsequently realized that it does not represent the whole story. For Jesus said, "Where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among them." I had now personally experienced this promise of Jesus and the remarkable power of people praying for the well-being of others. I began to see my life and each breath I am given as a living prayer to God and a way to pray for others and for our world. The last verse that became clear to my vision that day was this: "Give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God's in Christ Jesus for you." 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 18, English Standard Version. Double and triple wow. I was immediately reminded of the often told fable about giving thanks and being grateful for little things. When a poor man was given a loaf of bread, he thanked the baker. But the baker said, "Don't thank me. Thank the miller who made the flour." So the poor man thanked the miller, but the miller said, "Don't thank me. Thank the farmer who planted the wheat." So the poor man thanked the farmer, but the farmer said, "Don't thank me. Thank the Lord. He gave the sunshine and rain and fertility to the soil, and that's why you have bread to eat." The rest of the Bible, other written material, the television, and even the faces of those people I love continued to be blurry for several days. Due to this continued blurriness, I wasn't able to read anything other than these three Bible verses, couldn't watch TV, and didn't want to converse with anyone. All I did was read and reread these three verses. These are three of the briefest verses in the Bible. Yet I believe they are far-reaching and summarize much of what God asks of us. Chapter 17. Conversing with an Angel. Ask and you will receive. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Matthew 7, verse 7, Good News Translation. I spent a great number of hours contemplating what God was asking of me. Even before my boating accident, I did not really believe in luck or coincidence as phenomena. I believed that God has a hand in most things and that most of what happens is part of a larger plan. I was laying in my hospital bed, wondering about the purpose of my accident, when I suddenly found myself sitting on a rock in a large, sun-drenched field. I was having a conversation with an angel who was sitting on a nearby rock. I call the being an angel, but I don't really know what he was. Angel, messenger, Christ, or teacher. I do know that he was of God, in God, and from God. As we conversed, I asked questions, and he gave me answers. We discussed how to rejoice always, even in the midst of terrible circumstances, and discussed the long-standing question, why do bad things happen to good people? During this conversation, I received the following wisdom. We are each given the opportunity and privilege to come to earth for different reasons. Sometimes we come in order that we may personally develop and strengthen the fruits of our spirit, those of love, kindness, patience, joy, peace, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Sometimes we come to help someone else develop the fruits of the Spirit. We all come to earth to become more Christ-like, as noted in Romans 8. In preparation for our journey to earth, we are able to make a basic outline for our life. This is not to imply that we, the humans, are entirely in charge of our life's design. It is more like God creates it, then we review it and discuss it with our personal planning angel. Within the algorithm are written branch points in our lives, at which times we may exit, returning to God, or we may be redirected to a different task and goal. We may be directed to these branch points by our own conscious choice and by our circumstances, or we may be pushed along by angelic intervention. Have you ever shown up somewhere at just the right time? When you think back on your life, can you remember a person who briefly entered your life saying something or doing something that impacted your life out of proportion to what they actually said or did? What were the circumstances that brought you together with your spouse, or the detailed circumstances of other such notable events in your life? Have you ever been randomly thinking of someone who then unexpectedly shows up or contacts you? Has something ever happened that left you thinking, "That's weird"? Consider whether these are sets of coincidences, or whether they might be orchestrated events, evidence of God's hand in our lives. Although we are rarely aware of angels or their intervention in our world, I believe there are angels all around us every day of our lives. Angels are spirit beings who are mentioned more than 250 times in both the Old Testament and the New Testament of the Bible. They appear as creatures, events, and humans offering praise and worship to God. They care for, protect, and guide God's people, frequently intervening or bringing messages to people from God. They are the ones orchestrating the coincidences that occur so commonly in our lives. Of note is that most theologians would agree that angels live among us according to God's will, not our own. Lewis Sperry Chafer wrote in Systematic Theology, Kriegel, 1993, "One reason angels are rendered invisible to human sight may be that if they were seen, they would be worshipped. Man, who is so prone to idolatry as to worship the works of his own hands, would hardly be able to resist the worship of angels were they before his eyes." While often unrecognized, angels certainly seem to be present and active in our world today. A Newsweek article titled "In Search of the Sacred," November 1994, observed, 20% of Americans have had a revelation from God in the last year, and 13% have seen or sensed the presence of an angel. Angels often expose us to or push us into a situation that will force our redirection. Of course, our redirection is not really forced. Rather, as we are compelled to approach the fork in our road, we make a choice to turn left or turn right. Every choice leads us forward, and there is no going backward, no redo. Every choice we make today affects the choices that we face tomorrow. Planet Earth and the humans living on it are truly interconnected, and there is no action without some sort of reaction. Even the most terrible circumstances and events can stimulate great change in individuals and/or societies. Without observing cruelty, we would not be moved to compassion. Without personal trials, we would not develop patience or faithfulness. It is the recognition that our earthly concerns matter little when compared to life eternal that allows us to know joy in the midst of sorrow and worry. Have you ever really changed or experienced personal growth during times of comfort or complacency? The acceptance that change rarely comes without difficulty and challenge can truly free a person to rejoice always. It also allows us to live daily with a grateful heart and give thanks in all circumstances. No matter what the circumstances, we can be grateful that God fulfills His promises, that our faith is sufficient to sustain us, and that our eternal life is assured. Sometimes uncomfortable situations or irritating people are placed in our lives to lead us in a direction more in line with God's will. One example I like to use is that of a beggar who may sit outside of a wealthy businessman's office in an attempt to help that person develop more tolerance and compassion for others. I am able to see examples of this in my own life as well. Before my accident, the behavior of some of my colleagues deeply aggravated and irritated me. Afterward, while I still didn't like the behavior, I realized that I do not know their purpose on earth, nor why they are in my life. As difficult as it sometimes is to accept, I do know that God loves each of them every bit as much as He loves me. Rather than being irritated by their behavior, I now take joy in the knowledge that their behavior is teaching me patience, and I give thanks for this. I also began to pray for them, which has changed my perspective significantly. The exercise of praying for others, and I'm talking about praying with love, not praying as is humorously presented in the country western song, about praying for the car brakes to go out, the flower pot to fall, the engine to stall, and such, can lead to dramatic results and to greater peace and contentment. This exercise is definitely worth trying. As the angel sitting on the nearby rock continued his explanations and patiently answered my questions, I began to visualize a reasonable analogy for our individual lives. Each of us is like a small piece of thread that contributes to the weaving of a very large and very beautiful tapestry. We, as single threads, spend our lives worrying about our thread, what color it is and how long it is, even becoming upset if it becomes torn or frayed. The complete tapestry is far too large for us to see and of too complex a pattern for us to appreciate the importance of our single thread. Regardless, without our individual contribution, the tapestry would be incomplete and broken. We should therefore recognize and take joy in our contribution. Indeed, our threads, our lives, are important. What we do and the choices we make, even the seemingly small ones, actually make a difference. I find it interesting that when people describe how terribly awful some events or circumstances are, it is rarely the people directly involved who are doing this describing. I have spoken to person after person who has been at the center of a situation described by others as awful, tragic, or disastrous. Yet they themselves are grateful for the situation and would not change their circumstances if they were given the choice. My point is this. Interpreting something that happens as being inherently good or bad is entirely a matter of perspective. Do bad things happen to good people? I'm not so sure. Jesus was certainly a very good man. His crucifixion would certainly be interpreted by many as a bad thing. His disciples were devastated, yet the Old Testament prophecies would not have been fulfilled, and a new covenant with God would not exist if Jesus had not been crucified. From this perspective, it is difficult to declare that the crucifixion of Jesus was a bad thing. In fact, it is the very heart of the good news that Christians celebrate. Even when we are frustrated by our inability to understand a circumstance or event, there are unseen angels bringing comfort and protection as directed by the wisdom of God. Our only reasonable option is to rely on the word and promises of God. Chapter 18. The Patient Care Unit. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Psalm 118, verse 24, New International Version. When my health allowed for it, I was transferred to the Patient Care Unit, PCU. When I first arrived, I still had no pain to speak of and still felt wrapped in the cloak of God. I actually felt blissful. When people entered my room for the first time, they would literally take a step backward and with a look of surprise on their faces ask, "What is going on in here?" They would go on to describe a feeling of physical power and presence in the room. The first time someone noted this, I sort of ignored it. When it occurred again and again and with a variety of different people, I began to believe that they were feeling the almost palpable energy in my room. I should not have been surprised that they could feel God's presence. I could certainly feel it. It had been a couple of weeks since my accident, but I was still spending most of each day in pensive contemplation, trying to make sense of all that had happened. I believed that all things work together for good, and I began to contemplate the possible reasons for this accident. Before I knew it, I was once again sitting in a beautiful, sun-drenched field with an angel. The brilliance and intensity of the surrounding beauty and the purity of the angel's radiant love were simultaneously overwhelming and rejuvenating. We spoke for what seemed like many hours, and I never wanted to leave. We talked about the specifics of my accident, and I was given more information regarding many of the reasons I was returned to Earth. Later in this book, I will tell you about several of these directives, including the protection of my husband's health, being a rock of support for my family and community after the death of my son, helping others find their way back to God, and sharing my story and experiences. When our conversation was over and it was time for me to return, the angel kissed me on my forehead and bade me farewell. I knew it would be our last conversation, and with that kiss, much of what had been told to me seemed to be placed beneath a veil. I sensed that I could later choose to lift the veil and recall all of the words said to me if I really wanted to, but I also knew that I was expected to let them remain veiled. With my transfer to the PCU came the added joy of being allowed visitors. I looked forward to my children's first visit and ached with a longing to hold each of them tightly and reassuringly. When they arrived, my three older kids were reluctant to approach me, and my youngest stayed as far away from my bed as was possible. I imagine that I must have been frightening to see, and perhaps unrecognizable, with all of the various tubes and machinery attached to my body, but their hesitation was heartbreaking. Within a few days, their comfort was restored, and we spent glorious hours lying together in my hospital bed, watching movies and cuddling. Although I adored them and loved the time we spent together, part of me still longed to be with God. This realization made me feel torn and depressed. One afternoon, I was awakened by a visit from Al Forbes, one of the partners in my medical practice. He was a Christian man, and I felt I could tell him the details of my extraordinary experiences on the river. As I told him of drowning, of God's loving embrace, and of the miracles that had occurred, he began to cry. I asked why he was crying and was surprised when he told me that he was overcome with envy at my being so close to God and was crying because he was not usually an envious man. Not wanting to upset others, I then chose not to tell many more people the details or extent of my experiences with God. As my physical state became one of recovery rather than survival, I was more fully absorbed back into the reality of this world. My ties with God's world became less palpable until I was no longer able to pass between worlds or have conversations with angels. When my medical condition improved and my orthopedic partners, including my husband, were able to agree upon a treatment plan, I was finally able to undergo the first of several operations to surgically repair my various injuries. With this beginning of physical recovery, I also began to feel pain. The rest of my time in the hospital was challenging for everyone. I was still trying to process all that I had witnessed and continued to meditate on the three verses from 1 Thessalonians, but both of my legs were in casts, stretching from my toes to my hips, so I was unable to move and was able to do very little. Bill was at work during the day, the older kids were in school, and Peter was with our nanny, Cassandra. Since I was on my back with only the ceiling for my entertainment, I counted the small holes in each ceiling tile, again and again, first vertically, then horizontally, then diagonally. The excitement of coming up with the same number each time did little to diminish my boredom. Visitors were exhausting, but served as bright interludes to this otherwise dreary time. One friend rolled my bed into the sunshine that was delightfully streaming through a hallway window, and one thoughtful friend brought me some lavender body lotion that smelled like a field of fresh blossoms. Each time I rubbed some of this lotion on my hands, I would delight in its scent and be enveloped in a feeling of comfort and beauty. It meant so much to me at the time that I have saved the bottle. Now, when I occasionally open it and inhale the remnants of its fragrance, I am immediately reminded of my feeling of delight and fondly remember the person who gave it to me. After more than a month in the hospital, I was not sorry to pack up my belongings and go home. Chapter 19. My Physical Recovery. Life isn't about waiting for the showers to pass. It's about learning to dance in the rain. Vivian Green. I was excited to leave the hospital, but once I was home, I was emotionally depressed and physically miserable. Yes, I found joy in my circumstances, but that did not change my tangible, daily, physical reality. I had solid casts on both legs, which extended from my groin to my toes. I wasn't able to move around by myself, although I could stand upright on my own with a walker if someone first lifted me up. If no one was nearby to assist me, I was wheelchair-bound. Our rental house was probably built in the 1970s, with very narrow doors and hallways. A friend removed the doors from the hinges so I could be wheeled between my bedroom and the kitchen, but I was basically like a pet rock. After someone moved me into a room, I had to stay there until someone arrived to move me into a different location. While still in the hospital, I had developed blood clots in my legs that broke free and traveled to my lungs. To help dissolve the blood clots and avoid further complications, Bill gave me twice daily shots, not a pleasant experience for someone who detests being stuck with a needle. I was also taking narcotic pills for the pain and required help for even the most basic activities of daily living. The euphoria of visiting heaven was gone, replaced by the tedium of each day and the continued disbelief that I had been sent back to Earth. I was really quite glum. I had always been physically active and strong, and being physically immobile was emotionally difficult for me. It was challenging to follow the disciple James's dictum, "Consider it all joy when you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance." I thought I had developed enough perseverance. Scott was one of the nurse's aides at the hospital with whom Bill contracted to provide home health care to me a couple of times weekly. He was strong, nurturing, and always cheerful. I looked forward to these visits and relished the joyful energy he provided. He would move me from room to room, wash my hair, make my lunch, find the sunshine, and just sit with me. Despite these visits, I was languishing. Some of my more creative friends decided to take action. They attached two skis to the bottom of a snowmobile sled and built a seat inside the sled. Then they attached a handle to the back of the sled, making it possible for Scott to load me into the sled and push me along the snow-covered street outside my house. I was thus capable of being taken for a walk, like a baby in a pram. Sometimes I would be pushed slowly, but sometimes Scott would take me to one of the nearby hills and let me work up some speed in the sled while he ran behind. I began to take some short ski poles with me on these outings, and I became fairly competent at sitting in the sled while jubilantly steering it by digging the poles into the snow on one side or the other. Traveling in the sled was the only time I felt mobile, so it was magnificent. When I was in the sled, I felt alive. My family began to call Scott Sleigh Boy, since all I wanted to do when he arrived was to load up the sleigh and have him take me out. Scott was so helpful in my recovery that I was a little sorry to say goodbye when I became strong enough and mobile enough to finally care for myself. He has since left our town and become a physician's assistant. I have not heard from him for many years, but I recall him fondly and will always cherish the kindness he showed to me. My youngest son, Peter, was only 1.5 years old when I had my kayaking accident. He had been the most hesitant to be near me while I was in the hospital, but he never left my side once I returned home. For many months, his love, constancy, comfort, and a shared knowledge of God's presence kept me linked to him and through him to this world. Given his very young age, I believe he still remembered God's world, which seemed to give him an understanding of the spiritual aspect of my experience and what I was going through. My older children were great sources of joy, reassurance, and inspiration, And Cassandra, our wonderful nanny, provided a great sense of stability to all of us. Although I was physically present in our home, I was emotionally absent. I was quite absorbed into my own world of physical recovery and emotional turmoil as I tried to process all that had happened to me. It took me more than a year to finally accept that not only had I been sent back to Earth, but that I had work left to do. I was part of a family that I dearly loved, and I finally accepted that I better get on with my life and make the most of it. During this time, Bill was the glue that held our lives together. He worked full-time in his own orthopedic practice, maintained my orthopedic practice, cared for our children, changed Peter's diapers, made sure everyone was fed, administered my shots, and organized my medical treatment, all while trying to process his own feelings of helplessness and grief about what had happened. Despite being emotionally and physically drained, he was exceptional. The community in which we live was also so supportive of our family that it can make me cry even now to think about it. Someone from our church or elsewhere in our community brought food to our house every night for many months. Occasionally, people would spend their weekend holding down our fort so that Bill could go skiing or do something else for himself. We had not lived in our community for very long before my accident, so didn't even know most of these people, and many of them did not know us. But they embraced our need nonetheless, and their kindness to us was a tremendous blessing. Chapter 20. Bob. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. 2 Timothy 4, verse 7, New King James Version. 2 weeks after my discharge from the hospital, I received a phone call telling me that my father, Bob, was being taken off life support. What? Though my brain was working well and I could hear the words, I could not understand the information I was being given. I hadn't even known my father was in the hospital, so how could I possibly understand that his life-sustaining ventilator was being removed? As the story unfolded, I discovered that 2 weeks earlier he wasn't feeling well when he had been visiting my brother in San Francisco. Upon his return to Michigan, he developed severe pneumonia. My father was admitted to the hospital for treatment, but when his condition did not improve with antibiotics, he was placed on a ventilator in an attempt to improve his oxygen transfer. His condition continued to worsen despite this aggressive care, and when his internal organs sequentially failed, my stepmother made the decision to remove his external life support. Inexplicably, she had also made the decision not to contact me or any of my 3 siblings. We were all children from his previous marriage, when he was hospitalized, when his condition worsened, or before she made the final decision of removing his external life support. Over the years, my father's relationship with my siblings and me had been strained by the circumstances in which he lived. He often spoke of how desperately he wanted a close relationship with each of us, but his wife was entirely unsupportive of this and presented many obstacles. She was a widow with 5 children, several of whom still lived at home with her and my father. I just don't think she wanted to accept the fact that my father had a life prior to their marriage, or that he had 4 grown children of his own. She prevented him from having our photographs in their house, calling us from their home, or going out of his way to visit us. He cried often when discussing this with us, but was unable or unwilling to demand change. My father's impending death would make the strained relationships final and abolish any possibility of reconciliation. For these reasons, I knew the importance of our seeing our father before his last thread of connection to life was severed. Without speaking to my stepmother, I contacted my father's attending physician and pleaded with him to maintain the life support until my siblings and I could arrive. Although this would require my father to be on a ventilator an extra day or two, as we were each coming from distant parts of the country, he very grudgingly agreed to do so. I am chagrined to admit that his agreement came only after I acted like a bully. My siblings were at the airport when I arrived, and we drove directly to my father's hospital. When I entered the room where my father was lying in his hospital bed, I saw that he was sedated and the ventilator was rhythmically pushing air in and out of his lungs. Although he was still alive, I had the overwhelming sense, really more of a deep knowledge, that his soul had already departed from his body. He was already dead. Although it is a commonly held belief that a person's soul departs at the moment of their physical death, I have come to believe that the departure of the soul defines and determines the moment of death, rather than the body's physical death determining the moment of the soul's departure. With the use of modern medicine and technology, the organism that is our human body may continue to physically function and appear to be alive, but unless God sees a purpose to return the soul to its body, the person is essentially dead. Not only had I witnessed this during my surgical training, but there are far too many accounts of near-death experiences in which there is a description of the soul departing the shell of its not yet physically dead body to ignore this reality. My father had been a vivacious, active, and physically fit man. He and his twin brother had been National Collegiate Athletic Association track stars, part of an elite crowd of champions, and members of the NCAA Hall of Fame. My emotions were mixed as I had a chance to sit alone in the hospital room with my father's now pale and somewhat shrunken body. I felt joy for him, for his reunion with God, and I felt a little bit sorry for myself, as I still had not reconciled the need for my own return to Earth from the riverbank in Chile. I regretted that I did not have a final opportunity to express my love and gratitude to Dad for his life, and even more deeply saddened that I had never had the opportunity to tell him of my recent experiences in heaven. I could have given him a glimpse of the great joy awaiting his arrival, and I think that hearing about it would have made his departure more tranquil. My brothers, Rob and Bill, my sister, Betsy, our stepmother, and I were at my father's bedside when the ventilator tube was removed from his body and he slowly took his last breath. Afterward, Rob, Bill, Betsy, and I returned to our hotel room where we reminisced, cried, and laughed long into the night as each of us recalled our childhood adventures with our father. We spent the next several days organizing the flowers and programs while our stepmother tended to other aspects of his memorial service. To be fair, I should say that my siblings did the organizing while I waited in the car or wherever else they put me, since both of my legs were still immobilized in long casts, and it was a slow struggle for me to follow them with my walker. I already described the First Presbyterian Church in Kalamazoo, Michigan, as being elegant, old, and beautiful. During my father's funeral, the large, traditional stained glass windows bathed the main sanctuary with an array of color. As I sank into the familiar front row pew, I allowed my mind to go backward in time to embrace and re-experience the wonder I always felt as a child when looking at the images in those same windows. My father had been well known and well respected in our state, and it seemed that everyone in the region had turned out to pay their last respects. It was a long service, but the attendees were patient as I was painstakingly helped to rise from my wheelchair and step up to the podium to deliver one of his eulogies. By the time the bagpipes played Amazing Grace at the end of the service, I was thoroughly exhausted. My trip back to Wyoming required a change of planes in Cincinnati, Ohio. My flight to Salt Lake City was just beginning to board when the fire alarm in the terminal sounded. Despite having traveled extensively, I never had this experience and will probably never encounter it again. Everyone in the terminal was instructed to exit the building and stand outside on the tarmac. I tried to follow these instructions, but had no one to help me as I rolled myself along with the crowd. I was soon stranded in my wheelchair at the top of a very long stairway leading to the tarmac, and as the other people streamed outside, I began to cry in frustration. I was feeling extremely sorry for myself and my situation. There were no airport employees anywhere in sight, and thinking it was more important for Bill to stay in Wyoming with our children, I had declined Bill's offer to travel with me to Michigan. I just couldn't believe that after all I'd been through, I was going to die in a fire. I didn't even have a working cell phone to call for help or to phone in my last goodbyes. After a while, an airport employee saw me, and when I explained my predicament, told me, "Don't worry about it. It's just a false alarm anyway." Okay, God still had plans for me. Chapter 21. My Beloved George. You will find, as you look back upon your life, that the moments when you have really lived are the moments when you have done things in a spirit of love. Henry Drummond. After my return from Michigan, my mother arrived in Jackson Hole to help care for me and to help my husband care for our children. The day after her arrival, we discovered that my stepfather, like my father several weeks earlier, had just been admitted to his local hospital with a case of pneumonia. This was not George's first bout of pneumonia, as he had a form of myodysplasia, which is a blood disorder that frequently results in pneumonia. Remarkably, my father's pneumonia was caused by a similar blood disorder, something he had been living with but had kept secret until his final hospitalization. I spoke with George's physician, who reassured me that my stepfather appeared to be responding well to the antibiotics, so we should not be overly concerned. Despite this reassurance, my mother and I considered whether or not she should return to North Carolina to be with George. As we pondered this issue over our morning coffee, a great gray owl swooped down and landed on the deck railing adjacent to